So, Randy, we've been seeing quite a few new listeners recently.
You're kidding me.
No, we got like probably several thousand new subscribers.
That's amazing.
It's really amazing. And if you happen to be one of those people that's listening to the show for the first or second or third time, we just want to let you know we're super glad you're here and just want to tell you a little bit about ourselves.
Yeah, we're so grateful that you give us your time. That is so precious. We're so grateful that you just want to listen to our conversations, whether it's just the two of us or whether it's guests. We are grateful you're here and we love to hear from you. So whether that's getting in touch with us via email, social media, giving us guest recommendations, book recommendations, or if you have just any question for us about things that we talk about, we'd love to hear from you because we want to cultivate community. So welcome to the community, friends.
Yeah, welcome to the community. And if you do want to get in touch, look in the show notes. Our contact info is there, or just stay tuned to the end of the episode.
I'm Randy, the pastor half of the podcast, and my friend Kyle's a philosopher. This podcast hosts conversations at the intersection of philosophy, theology, and spirituality.
We also invite experts to join us, making public a space that we've often enjoyed off-air, around the proverbial table with a good drink in the back corner of a dark pub.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. Well, we've got a fun episode, an episode actually where Kyle and I disagree about something.
Woo!
Yeah. It's not super uncommon, I don't think, but...
You know, I thought it would be more common when we started this. I was a little disappointed.
Yeah, I know.
I thought there were more things you were wrong about.
So part of my journey in my spiritual evolution that I've, you know, been on, I feel like things have slowed down for me, the changes to my maturing and evolution of my faith. That's slowed down, but for the last several years, there's been a number of things that have influenced this faith evolution or spirituality journey that I've been on, and part of that is science.
Hmm.
Reading more about science and reading books that kind of intermingle science and theology and who God is compared to what we're learning about the universe and the cosmos. And I've been convinced that my view of God and our view of God needs to change and grow and mature along with our understanding of the universe and the understanding of the cosmos, because the God that I was given, that I was raised with, is not big enough to handle and hold all the new scientific understanding that we're learning and discovering right now. That God cannot exist compared to the James Webb telescope, you know, discoveries and Hubble telescope and all the stuff. We've been on this trajectory of scientific discovery for the last century, and it's just exponentially growing as we speak. You know, decades get faster and faster, and what we're learning about science and about the universe, about cosmology, about even biology, all the stuff. And I feel like we need a God that's big enough to hold it all. So that's been a fun concept for me to think about, to read about all of that. And what it also does, it helps me worship, actually. The more I learn about the universe, the more I learn about life, the more I learn about science, in many ways, the more I am in awe of reality, of existence, and then of God, because I believe that there is an origin to all of it that we call God, the ground of all being. And I like it when we have scientific conversations within church circles. I like it when we bring scientific fact or discovery into spiritual conversations. And Kyle, you're not such a big fan of
it. It makes me uncomfortable. Yeah, I don't want to totally shit on everything you just said, but some of it does make me pretty uncomfortable, and I'm really cautious about taking that line of thinking too far in either direction, in the direction of science is influencing my view of God, or my theology is influencing my view of science and its place in society and my life or whatever. I think you can go wrong real fast in both directions.
Yeah, probably can.
And we're going to talk about some examples of that. And I tend to think they should maintain a healthy distance from one another, kind of like, I don't know, divorced parents who still get along and like go to the kid function. But you don't want it to be any more intimate than that. You know what I'm saying? Like, each has their role to play, and we tried blending them and it didn't work out. So
yeah. And I wouldn't be an advocate for blending them, but I would be an advocate for being a really good, healthy, separated family.
Okay.
And we can,
well, we might end up a little closer than I expected, but some of the stuff you just said still made me a little uncomfortable. So we'll see how far you want to push it. Before we do that, though,
yes,
let's taste a beverage. If you're joining us for the first time, one of the things we do around here is we take the bar part of our title really seriously, and we taste an adult beverage together to set the mood. And this time, Randy brought it.
Well, our friend Jake brought it.
Hey, Jake.
Our friend Jake generously gave us some bourbon to share. I've had it, and I want to tell you it's fun. It's Oppidan Smoke and See, which I guess Elliot told me that we've already sampled Oppidan in our early episodes.
Which one was that? It's like 4-grain or something?
Yeah, the 4-grain... mash.
Producer Elliot, what did you say about the Oppidan that we had?
Yeah, we had the 4-grain. I don't think we liked it.
I don't remember it.
I thought one of us did, but I don't remember who.
Dusty library book. Mm-hmm. Like, Hey Ma on the Tongue is what I remember.
Okay.
Well,
so it wasn't great, but that's Mashbill is part of this, right?
It is. So it's a combination of their Four Grains straight bourbon and their Solera aged bourbon Mashbill, finished in French oak and peated Islay Scotch barrels.
Yeah.
So that's why it's called Smoke and See.
Yeah.
And of course, it sounds suspect and weird, but let's have a go.
Yeah. So right off the bat, you don't get any of the peat in the nose.
Oh, yeah, I do.
I don't. Maybe it's because I drink so much Isle of Scotch, but if I'm looking for that, I don't find it.
It smells like peated bourbon to me.
Although technically, I guess it's peat-finished bourbon, not so much peated.
Do you smell anything, Elliot?
The French countryside oak trees. No, I don't really smell anything.
Yeah, last time I was in South of France, that's exactly what it smelled like.
Is the French oak more special than like Italian oak?
No idea.
I mean, I think it's got a little bit too much of the mason jar that it's been sitting in for the last couple months. But it tastes like a mix of bourbon and scotch to me.
It does, yes. The peat is very present on the palate.
Told you I could smell it.
Yeah, I like that. If we were going in blind and you asked me to identify the spirit, I'm not sure I
would say scotch.
Really Everybody hard. Would yeah. say scotch, yeah. And it would be a reasonable guess.
Because it tastes like it's peated. Yeah, it's pretty fun. But you get the caramely, rich sweetness of a bourbon matched with that peaty smokiness of a scotch. I think it's
Which is hard
blast.
To find in the world of scotch. Mm-hmm. It exists, but it's very expensive. Most of it's like just a totally different end of the flavor spectrum, right?
Probably aged
brighter,
really long, right?
Sea-like notes. And it's old and imported, so you're going to pay a pretty penny for it. Mm-hmm. So this is a nice blend. Do you know what the price point is on this?
Yeah, I think it's like 40 or 45 bucks.
Wow. So if you're looking for the flavor of a scotch and the sweetness of a bourbon and you don't want to pay $100 for
this
a bottle
is it.
Of scotch, this is it.
Yeah, no, I got it as an experiment. I got it as a gift for my friend. And then as soon as I tasted it, I was like, do you mind if I have a few ounces for the podcast? Because it was fun. Yeah, exactly. Classy. Mm-hmm. He's that good of a friend that I'm able to do that. But yeah, if you see Oppidan Smoke and See, wherever you see it, whether it's Story Hill or BKC, your local liquor store, grab it. Let us know what you think, because we think it's fun.
Yeah. Thanks, Jake.
Cheers.
Cheers. So we talk a lot about our Patreon supporters around here. That's because we're super grateful for them.
Love them.
And every now and then we like to shout out one of our top shelf Patreon supporters. And so this time we want to say hey to Greg Eglund. Thanks so much for being a top shelf supporter.
Greg Eglund, cheers to you.
Cheers.
We're so grateful you help us make this thing go. Another thing we like to do is thank people and read reviews. Thank you for writing reviews and leaving a review. And we got a new review and we're grateful for it. So Frick a Fracker. I'm assuming that doesn't have anything to do with mining or anything, but Frick a Fracker says, great show, great conversations. And they say, the guys are great and always have meaningful things to say. And the guests always wow me with their knowledge. Frick a Fracker, thank you for leaving that review.
Thanks. Your reviews don't have to be super long to make it on the show.
So Kyle, you're a philosopher. You have your PhD to show, give us proof that you're a philosopher. So you're not a scientist.
I'm not. I'm not even a philosopher of science. I should say that at the outset.
Okay.
This is like a hobbyist interest.
Yeah. But when you take something up as a hobby, I know you well enough to know that like you don't mess around. You dive in deep. So this episode is going to be basically, this is your episode. And I'm going to tell you where I think you're wrong, or I'm going to ask you questions.
Deal.
And producer Elliot might do the same thing. But tell us why you are skeptical when you see science and religion mingled.
Yeah, well, let me just claim at the beginning here, as I said, not a scientist, not a philosopher of science, not an expert in this field at all, and I'm well aware that everything we're going to talk about is enormously complicated, mm-hmm. and I know that I'm skirting the surface of all of it. I'm going to, like, maybe obliquely reference a difficulty here and there, and you're going to think, oh, that's not a big deal. He just solved it. Moving on, and any philosopher listening is going to be like, holy shit, what did he just...
First of all, I don't really give a shit what the philosophers say. Second of all, good news for you. I'm a pastor, so I'm an expert at everything.
oh. Yes, we have a few episodes about that. If you look back on
I'm kidding for those of you who are really pissed right now. I'm totally kidding.
So why am I annoyed by this? There's a couple reasons, and I see it in both directions, as I was saying in the introduction. One of the things that annoys me the most, and this seems to be the more popular version of this that I'm seeing in recent years, so the last, 5 to 10 years, is that a lot of religious people, with, all sincerity, as far as I can tell, think that some new discovery in science has confirmed or strengthened or mm-hmm. formed their view of God somehow. Mm-hmm. And they get like really zealous about that mm-hmm. and really excited about that and mm-hmm. worked up about that and kind of evangelical about it. And then a few years later, let's say that scientific insight is overturned and you never hear anything from them, or it just kind of fizzles, proves to be the fad that, you know, that it was. And that seems to happen a lot, especially for some reason around quantum mechanics. People love quantum mechanics. I heard, so this happens on a very popular level, but I also heard like a world-renowned, extraordinarily respected philosopher make an argument that rooted a central premise of the argument in a metaphor or an analogy between quantum mechanics and God's nature that I thought was just hopelessly flawed. So there are sophisticated versions of this too. That philosopher shall remain nameless, but it's a big deal. But more often than not, it's these popular level things. And I think it's because quantum mechanics particularly lends itself to mysterious weirdness.
Yeah.
Because nobody knows what the hell's going on there, right? There's all these theories about how you can make sense of it, and all of them have huge problems, and they're all super strange.
No, so, it's not huge problems. They're all held together by love. All
exactly,
things.
But that's such an easy move, right? So one of my good friends used to make fun of me for my love of the movie Interstellar. I don't know if you've seen this.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll defend that movie all day, but I understand one critique of it, which is that in the end, spoiler, like love is the answer to everything, mm-hmm. including science, kind of. And that is a very common view amongst a certain kind of religious person. And that annoys me because inevitably the people making those claims have no clue what they're talking about at all. And the experts in those fields don't think that those two things have anything to say to each other. Almost always. There are exceptions, and we can talk about some of the exceptions, but the vast majority of experts in both physics, for example, and I think theology, insofar as they're informed by, like, you know, they keep track of what the physicists are doing, don't think those things have much to do with each other. And I would, in fact, I can't name a single serious physicist who would think that those things, that quantum mechanics has anything at all to do with, like, the nature of Jesus,
yeah,
for
well,
example.
So now, of course, a physicist won't feel like, oh, I'm getting really close now, and all of a sudden they'll have this discovery of what holds atoms and
right.
particles together or whatever, and holy shit, I think it's the love of God.
Right.
You know, like,
right.
obviously now, that's not going to happen. However, I think you can believe and not be deluded or stupid. You can believe it in dumb ways, maybe. Mm. But I think you can believe in, like, I believe that God is love. That means that I believe that the ground of all being and what the origin of all life in the universe is love.
Yeah.
And it's like all of science is kind of like this, you can say, explaining how that came to be, but mm-hmm. you can still believe
Absolutely.
That the universe is held together by love.
Yes, but I want to make the case, or, you know, defend the claim that when you believe that, as all humans must believe all sorts of things at the same time, you're believing them in fundamentally different ways.
Yes.
In ways that you ought not to make the attempt to make them consonant.
Yeah, you can say what I just said, as long as you say this isn't scientific.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, good. But a lot of people want it to be scientific, right?
Yeah.
And there are, you know, there are really well-known exceptions to the kind of thing I'm saying. So John Polkinghorne, for example, was a rare exception of someone who was a trained physicist and also a trained theologian and thought there was a great deal of fruitful overlap. I'm not sure if he would take issue with the view I'm going to defend in this episode, but he might have. People like Francis Collins is like a very well-known example of a serious scientist, and then, like, you know, head of the Human Genome Project and all the other stuff that he went on to do, who, like, very famously wrote a book about this, found God in his science mm-hmm. in a significant way. And, you know,
there's people like Teilhard de Chardin, who is a Jesuit priest
right.
and also a paleontologist, and
yeah.
speaks to a yeah. lot of what I just said is in a lot of Teilhard. Mm. And also Ilia Delio. I'm trying really hard to get her on the show
right.
while she still can. She's a scientist, PhD in both science and theology.
Right.
So she has a fun voice.
Yeah.
I think there are voices that mix these two together in kind of a very unique and striking view of reality. And it's informed by both sides of their education.
Yeah, so that definitely happens. And, you know, I'm obviously not trying to discount all those people or anything like that. But I do think the temptation to take that kind of syncretism, is what I'll call it later, mm-hmm. tendency to take that too far, is just very tempting.
Yep.
And often the thing that happens with journalists a lot, especially in science journalism, also happens when people get a little overexcited about the two things that they're interested in coming together. And the thing that happens with journalists is you'll have a really sensational headline about some like recent scientific discovery. And then if they're careful journalists, you won't find any justification or support for that headline in mm-hmm. the body of the article, or the whole article will be sensationalist. And like you ask the actual scientist who made the discovery, what do you think of this article about it? And they won't even recognize the discovery in the article, sure. right? Because you want to get clicks and you want to sell papers or whatever. So that same tendency happens when people get super excited about these two things I love being compatible with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that annoys me. In the other direction, a thing that has annoyed me for years, and this is a little older, I noticed this more when I was in college in the early 2000s, but I guess it's still around, and that is the kind of new atheist types mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. who think that science has disproven religion.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation between them is important and everyone should be having it, and it comes out only one way, and that is that religious people are dumb
yeah.
or deluded.
Yeah.
Right. That is also a very annoying mistake that ironically puts them closer together than I think they should be.
Mm-hmm.
Because it assumes they're doing the same kind of project and that science is doing it way better. And so the religious people need to just get out of it.
Yeah, and to the scientists or new atheist defense, I think they're critiquing a brand of Christianity that actually does think that they're yeah. doing work of science, you know?
That's totally fair.
And yeah. that should be critiqued. I mean, and that's the thing. I think all three of us grew up in a world that we were given like a young earth creationism. Were you guys? Yeah. And that means that we were given a not accurate version of science. You know, I went to Christian grade school, middle school, high school. And all of the science that I was given was heavily edited. And I was kind of warned as I was heading into college that, like, this is what you're going to experience, you know? And that should be critiqued.
Yeah.
If that's your world, we love you. We're really glad you're listening. And we want to just humbly say, maybe that's not real science.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be really kind.
Yeah, no. We were literally all there.
All of us were raised in it.
I mean, I was adamant. I mean, I was also a child, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea what I was talking about. But yeah, young earth creation. I was the kid who tried to like argue with the professor freshman year. So mm-hmm. like, you know, we understand what it's like to be there.
Totally. Yeah.
And it seems like young earth creation, it's kind of a like a proxy for this greater debate. Like so much gets tied up here, but then it's extended. So if you come up in that type of a upbringing and then you go into those college classes and you say it's a thoughtful, more scientifically minded kid, they're like, oh, everything I've been told was a lie. And so then they have to discard that entire, yeah. the Bible, God, their upbringing, everything goes out the window. So that's on one side, becomes a proxy for something much larger. Or on the other side, that distrust of science can extend so far. And we've seen the effects of that in massive ways the last several years.
Yep.
Where those who are going to cling to scripture as science textbook have to then apply it in some really absurd ways far beyond young earth creationism.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've found in the last couple of years with anti-vaxxers turning into anti-COVID vaxxers and then turning into anti-maskers and all, you know, anti-Fauci people, anti-science, mm-hmm. is there is a consequence. There's a real societal consequence to distrusting science and yeah. being told and brainwashed that you can't trust academia, you can't trust experts, you can't trust scientists. We lived through that real life consequence
yeah.
when half of our country didn't believe the experts that were telling us how to combat this pandemic. I was saying to my wife all along, like, of course this happened, because I've listened to people that I know that I'm close with for years talk about how my kids are going to get autism if yeah. we give them a vaccine, or, you know, they believe in essential oils more than actual medicine and all that stuff. And I'm not saying essential oils are terrible. I'm just saying we were kind of built to not believe experts when we really needed them most.
Yeah, built by, in many ways, the young earth creationists, or at least the structures that produced the young earth
creationists. Kind of where it came from.
Right? Yeah, anybody that lived through Answers in Genesis as a teenager was not surprised by the backlash against the elite establishment of experts during COVID at all. It was a trajectory, it was a logical conclusion of the trajectory that a lot of people in the country have been on for a long time. Not just in the U.S., actually. It's a global phenomenon.
And here's a question. I've thought of this for a while. All of us will be processing COVID and all that went down during COVID for decades, right? But one thing that I've been thinking about, and what would you say as a philosopher, and Christians are my people. Like, I'm a Christian. I'm a Christ follower. But I think Christians / religious people are particularly susceptible to brainwashing and manipulation and conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a sociologist, so I don't have like data on how much more susceptible they are to it than other people. I think there is data on like sort of rigid cognitive processes or habits that are associated with fundamentalist religious belief that are correlated strongly with belief in misinformation and conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that is, if not established, at least strongly supported sociologically. We talked with T. Nguyen on a while back. Mm-hmm, if you haven't mm-hmm. listened to that episode, go check it out.
So fun.
His theory about that, when we broached the question with him, is that it has to do with this like feeling of having solved something or figured something out, being
knowledge
really
porn.
Pleasurable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And we've kind of been habituated into that in our religious spaces because, you know, for better or worse, whether it's true or not, the religious hypothesis, of course, there's more than one, but I mean the idea that there is a grand meaning to it all and that there's a person behind it all makes sense of a lot of stuff that would otherwise be extraordinarily stressful in life, right? All the stuff that gave the existentialists thousands of pages to write. If you're a theist, it's not such a big deal because there's a ready explanation for a lot of it. That's regardless if you're a Christian or not, just being a theist and thinking somebody's behind this guiding it. That helps a lot, and it feels psychologically nice mm-hmm. to be able to kind of punt to that. Mm-hmm. And so if you're already kind of primed to that, then mm-hmm. when you encounter a grand explanation in the form of conspiracy theory, it's the sort of thing that you've experienced before, and you're going to naturally gravitate to it. Whereas if, you know, if you've grown up in an environment where everything is questioned, everybody's suspicious, nothing is for sure, that would be stressful in a lot
that
of ways, but
it
would also prime you to be a little more suspicious of like yeah. new grand theories as well.
Yep. And maybe big pharma, like, let's just be yeah. honest, right? So we've strayed quite a bit.
We have.
Let's
I think
get
that
down
was an important
here.
Tangent.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were talking about evolution. So this is a good example. So we could say there's maybe two ways you could go wrong here with the relationship between science and religion. You could think they're too similar. That would be syncretism, which we'll talk about a little bit later. You could also think that there's this conflict, that there's this hostility between them. And that's where I want to spend most of our time, this idea that religion and science are in conflict. I don't think they are, but not for the reasons that you often hear that they're not. Usually the answer to why are they not in conflict is some version of syncretism.
Yeah, I can already feel
because
we're not
going to actually get along.
I can already feel it though, Kyle. We're not going to disagree as much as we hoped.
Maybe. We'll yeah. see when we get to some specific
I'll try.
Examples.
I will try.
So that's what I want to spend most of our time on. And like, there's good and bad ways to make that conflict claim, right? So there's some bad reasons, some not so good reasons for thinking there's conflict between science and religion. One of them is what we were just talking about, that scientists are part of some untrustworthy elite cabal of, mm-hmm. you know, experts that are, you know, running the world or whatever. That's a bad reason. Young Earth
funny.
Creationism, obviously, is kind of a bad reason. Even with respect to evolution specifically, there's a couple of different ways you can go. There's like kind of a good faith version of that kind of objection that, you know, you can be a reasonable person and relatively informed and think that evolution poses a problem for religious belief. You could also do that in a really uninformed and bad faith way. I think the young earth creationist, I'm not a monkey, is a bad faith objection because,
yes,
I mean, that's just not what evolution is. It doesn't really have anything to do with what
no
any scientist has said.
Yeah.
But a more good faith version of that kind of objection or worry would be something like, well, isn't evolution random? Right. If you ask a scientist to explain evolutionary theory, we had an episode specifically about evolution and creation, if you want to hear more about that. But, you know, you're going to get something along the lines of there are these random genetic mutations that fuel natural selection and various other selective processes aimed only at adaptiveness to one's environment and sexual reproduction. And so fitness for the purpose of reproduction. And that's all the purpose there is. And at bottom, it's random. And that does sound a little inconsistent on the surface with how most
intelligent
religious
design.
People yeah. think about the world. Even if you don't go as far as ID, right? You just think that there's a God behind it all.
And a purpose behind it.
Yeah, a purpose going in some direction that's meaningful. That does sound inconsistent. So that's a more kind of principled objection. I don't think it's a genuine worry. Mm-hmm. I think if you look into what scientists actually mean or should mean when they're acting responsibly within their domain, by words like random, you don't actually run into a contradiction there. Random just means something like There's nothing within a single organism ensuring that it gets the adaptations or mutations that it needs to succeed in its environment.
Yeah, it's not a foolproof pattern.
No, no. And in fact, you know,
even though it might be a pattern.
It might be, but evolution can go in any direction that is required, right? So a mutation might just as well lead an organism to become less complex in order to fit its environment as to become more complex, which is one of the things those young earth creationists never quite seem to understand. Mm-hmm. It's not aimed at any specific like outcome, right? Mm-hmm. And that's all scientists mean by it. And I think that's perfectly compatible with theism. So that's like a more informed or good faith version of that objection, but still I think ultimately not a real worry.
Sure.
Another version of that would be something like evolution makes the problem of suffering really difficult. I mean, it's already really difficult. It makes mm-hmm. it even more difficult, especially if you care at all about animals. But even if you don't, you think that, you know, humans have been around for a couple hundred thousand years, and like 99.9% of that time was just abject suffering. That's difficult to square with Christianity. And so I don't want to downplay that either, but I would say there that we're not talking about a conflict between science and religion. We're talking about a conflict between the fact of the world revealed by science and a particular theology, mm-hmm. which says that God is good. Mm-hmm. And that's a real problem, but it's not a problem with science vis-a-vis religion. Does
yeah, we don't
sense?
Need to get into theodicy here.
No, we'll have a whole separate episode on mm-hmm. that eventually. So those are, you know, bad ways of describing the conflict. Another bad way is what the new atheists do, which we already mentioned. I don't need to name those people, but you know who they are. So that's kind of mostly from the religious side. I would put the new atheists on the religious side, actually, because I think they're doing sure. a very religious thing. From the science side, some not so good reasons for thinking there's a conflict. Here I would name people like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who just
it's interesting. He seems like such
way,
a nice
man.
Guy.
I know. I'm sure. I can't tell if you're being sarcastic.
No,
are you being sarcastic?
No, I'm being serious.
Okay.
Yeah,
because he seems
funny
like
guy.
Just the most pretentious. I couldn't be okay. in a room with. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he is a nice guy in person, but like he wholesale subscribes. Not just him. There's a whole cadre of people like this. To this view that science saved us from the dark ages of religion. Mm-hmm. Like literally the first episode of the Cosmos reboot is all about this. And he just takes you through the details of how, you know, the church persecuted Galileo. And that was just this microcosm of this larger thing that had been going on forever. And the church has resisted and persecuted scientific heroes at every turn, basically just trying to, you know, claw them back from these discoveries, ignoring completely that many of those people were devout religious people themselves.
Yes.
And that there's larger contextual histories here, and that there's no such thing as a dark ages. Like, all this is a very common and pervasive yeah. view about the conflict of science
for
and religion.
For such a smart person, it's not
exactly.
a smart argument.
And it yeah. almost always comes from really smart people in their domain who are stepping outside their domain.
Yeah.
I'm going to reference a paleontologist named Stephen Jay Gould here in a little bit. He wrote a book about this that I'm going to recommend, and in it he uses this myth, and it's this idea that a lot of people in his generation seem to grow up with, which was that until Columbus, most people thought the world was flat. Mm-hmm. That you've heard of this, I would assume, right? Was this a myth that was around when you were a kid?
Sure.
Yeah. So I wonder how common that still is. Hopefully not very, but it was at one point not very long ago extraordinarily common, and it just plays into this whole warfare motif between science and religion, right? Because you had this intrepid discoverer who goes out and like disproves this thing rooted in, you know, religious ignorance in the dark ages that the world was flat. Of course that's false, right? Like Aristotle had numerous arguments for the spherical shape of the earth, and like it was demonstrated many times way before Christianity that the world was, and like no one believed otherwise. That's the thing. And so like you have myths like this that arise apparently just for the purpose of solidifying this view that science and religion are in conflict.
Yeah, and that's so interesting because there's been a new rise of flat earthers, you know,
yeah.
And most of them seem, I could be wrong, but most of the flat earthers that I've heard of are fundamentalist Christians.
Mm.
And
that's concerning.
It is concerning. And I just don't know where and why that came from in our modern era.
Yeah.
How could, I just don't understand
I'm
that.
I'm sure
and
the
why.
Answer is some version of the internet.
Yeah. It's the same thing of why we don't believe in, you know, why we think Fauci is out to get us mm-hmm. and all that stuff. It's just. It confuses
yeah.
me. It's
I mean,
sad.
I remember when I was in college, I had a classmate who was just kind of goofy and funny, and somehow flat earth, you know, people came up. There was a flat earth society at the time, but it wasn't as popular.
Yeah,
and
Marquette?
No, this was at my undergrad, okay. And he was pretending to be a flat earther. And I was like, give me some proof, man. And he pulls out a quarter from his pocket and sets it up on its edge and flicks it, and it spins real fast. And of course, a quarter spinning real fast looks like a sphere. And he's like, yeah. And, but, you know, that was in, when was that? And he was joking, of course, but, you know, that was in maybe 2006, something like that. An argument of that quality in 2015, say, can gain thousands of people, maybe even more than that, seriously taking it seriously on the internet in a way that couldn't have happened even in 2006.
Have you heard of Birds Aren't Real?
Yeah.
It's just like
that. It's a prime example of that sort of thing. Yeah, because, you know, whatever. We don't have to talk anymore about that. So that's, you know, that's a version from the perspective of science, a bad version of this view that they're in conflict. There's also, you know, better versions of it from that side too that we can talk about. There are responsible, careful scientists who think that science has, at least the consensus of scientists, has settled on some things that would be very difficult to square with any extant religious view of the world. And you could be a principled practicing scientist and believe something like that. Again, I would think it would be a mistake and a little overblown, but it's possible.
Too big of a jump, but possible.
Yeah. There's also the view that science somehow entails that religion is false because science is naturalistic. Mm. That word naturalistic does all the work there. And this is something, this is the place when I warned you at the beginning of the episode that I was going to say something and it was going to sound simple. And then a lot of people were going to get pissed if they knew anything about what I was talking about. This is that. There's a whole literature on naturalism and what it might mean, methodological versus metaphysical naturalism, that sort of thing. I'm going to say here, just for the purposes of this conversation, because I think it's true in enough cases that it makes it worth saying, that when scientists talk about science being naturalistic, they're talking about it in a methodological sense, which means that for the purposes of the enterprise that we're engaged in and the rules of that enterprise that we've agreed to get the kind of information that we're trying to get about the world, we're going to say at the outset that we're going to assume there's nothing hokey or supernatural or metaphysical going on here, and we're just going to go based on our observations and the experiments that we can make on our observations, and we're going to conclude using the scientific method, whatever the hell that ends up being at the end of the day, we're going to conclude what we know about the world based on that, and we're going to call that fact if it's really well established. And if it's not verifiable according to that, in some sense of verifiable, then we're going to say we're unsure if that's true about the world. And, you know, that is naturalism. We call it naturalism, but it's not equivalent to the claim that the natural world is all there is. So that would be kind of metaphysical naturalism with a capital N. And that would entail atheism, right? Unless you think, you know, unless you're a pantheist, I guess. But if you're a classical theist and you think God has made the world and is bigger than it, then that kind of naturalism would entail atheism. But those are different claims. They're obviously different claims that, you know, we're trying to settle this kind of question under these particular constraints in this context is different from saying whatever we find out from that method has got to be all there is. And there are lots of scientists who will speak loosely or very intentionally take that too far. And I think that's a mistake as well.
Yeah. I mean, as you're talking about the naturalist stuff, that makes sense that a scientist would have to do that, would have to make a conscious decision to say everything that we find is going to be evidence-based, not
exactly
something going on.
And evidence, however, means a very specific thing in this context.
Yeah. However, there are scientists who, in the act of that project, giving their life to it, became believers in a higher power or God or whatever. Yeah. And they were giants in their field. Like Alan Sandage is one who was a really, really influential astronomer who I just looked it up because I studied him a little bit for some sermons that I did, which is going to annoy this crap out of you. But it says he published the first reliable measurement of the universe's expansion rate. Like he's a big deal. And he basically just said, the deeper I dug, the more complex things got and the more related things got. And it made most sense to him at that point to just believe in God, in a God. And I think he then went to Christianity. But that's fascinating to me that there's people like that as well. Scientists who in the act of their field and being experts in their field, they're like, I think I need to believe in God now.
Yeah, a similar thing that happened with I don't know if like Francis Collins was a kind of conversion, but I think it was something like that. It was, you know, through research that he came to see the enormous complexity and maybe design and in the universe, and that just made more sense of the whole thing than being an atheist did. So yeah, I can kind of respect that. It really depends on what is then done with the two domains, because do you lean then too far into trying to make predictions about one from the other.
I would hope not.
That
yeah.
would be a mistake. Other people, like very famously, Georges Lemaître was a Jesuit priest who was one of the first to solve Einstein's equations and predict the expansion of the universe and the existence of black holes, I'm pretty sure. And this was before Einstein could accept that sort of thing, but has since been confirmed. I mean, and that's, you know, coming from a place of deep religious conviction, mm-hmm. practicing priest. So, yeah, there's many, many examples of that sort of thing. Newton famously himself mm-hmm. was not only religious, but might have, don't quote me on this, but might have flirted. He was a kind of biblical literalist and might have flirted with a kind of young earthism.
No way.
I think that might be true.
I mean, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably enough about bad ways of
I think so.
Thinking about the conflict between science and religion. A better way, I think, is what has been called non-overlapping magisteria, NOMA for short, by a paleontologist named Stephen Jay Gould. And interestingly, I recently revisited his view because when I was a young, you know, budding apologist for Christian faith, like, he got a bad rap. And interestingly, around the time that I was doing that, Richard Dawkins came out with his book called The God Delusion. And he mentions Gould and NOMA at the beginning of the book and says the very same thing about it that all the Christian apologists were saying.
Interesting.
They had the exact same critique of it. They all thought he was wrong. And it's because they agreed that these two things should be in conversation, that they are in conflict, and that one of them wins. The only difference between Dawkins and the Christian evangelical apologists was that he thought evolutionary science won, mm-hmm. and they thought God won. But there's a real conflict, and one eventually has to bow to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And Gould was out here saying, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, these things probably shouldn't really even be talking much to each other. They're doing different things.
Mm-hmm.
They have magisteria, as he put it, which is...
What does that mean?
A very carefully chosen word. It comes from Catholicism, and it's the teaching arm of Roman Catholicism, the teaching arm of the church.
Sure. Okay.
So the people who decide doctrine are the magisteria.
Yeah.
They have teaching authority, in other words.
The magistrates.
And they have, like, methods that they use to arrive at their conclusions. And then once they pronounce on something, it's authoritative mm-hmm. for adherents or mm-hmm. followers. And so Gould is using that as kind of an analogy to say science and religion have their own sets of methods and their own kinds of questions that they're dealing with. And sometimes those questions overlap. What doesn't and can't overlap is the way that they investigate them, their styles of inquiry, their methods of inquiry. They're fundamentally different. And when you try to use the methods of one to reach conclusions about the other, you always make mistakes. It's a pretty kind of hard line view. They're non-overlapping. That's the part of that. So separate magisteria, but interestingly, they're often talking about the same stuff, and they should be, he was very insistent about this, they should be in constant conversation. And the conversation should be uncomfortable and often intense. But what should never happen is that we try to use the methods of one to pronounce on the other. Or try to blend the methods. They just can't happen. So he wrote this little book, which I recently read, just revisited, called Rocks of Ages. This is a
nice,
fun
good,
little pun.
Good.
He was a paleontologist, and obviously there's some, you know, geological joke there as well. And so, in, you know, he makes the case for NOMA in that book. Highly recommended. It's like less than 100 pages. And in that, I'm going to quote him here. He says, each domain of inquiry, so science and religion, frames its own rules and admissible questions and sets its own criteria for judgment and resolution. In other words, it has its own kind of method.
Mm-hmm.
These accepted standards and the procedures developed for debating and resolving legitimate issues define the magisterium or the teaching authority of any given realm. No single magisterium can come close to encompassing all the troubling issues raised by any complex subject, especially one so rich as the meaning of our relationship with other forms of life. Instead of supposing that a single approach can satisfy our full set of concerns, we should prepare to visit a picture gallery where we can commune with several different canvases, each circumscribed by a sturdy frame. The frame being the method, right? The pictures in the gallery go together to form your experience, but they are distinct. Mm-hmm. And it's part of their beauty of the experience, if you want to use that metaphor, is their distinctness, right? It's that you're experiencing them separately and they're giving you different things. And I think this is right. I think he's unfairly maligned and misunderstood by both sides of the religion and science are in conflict crowd. And they, yeah, I think they both miss something really important here. And it's really just, he admits this explicitly in this book, it's an extension of this very famous distinction in philosophy called the is-ought distinction. Hmm. This is another place where anybody philosophically informed is like, oh, what's he going to say? Where's he going to come down on this? And Gould knows that this is controversial. But I think he has a very long footnote where he's like, but it's right enough, isn't it, guys? Like, don't we mostly agree about this? Like, it comes from Hume, basically, who said you can't derive an ought claim, something should be the case, from an is claim, something is the case. So if I'm an evolutionary biologist and I look into the history of human evolution or animal evolution in general, and I say, you know, look at how all these things adapted to have these violent tendencies, survival of the fittest kind of thing. Nature is red in tooth and claw, as they said back in the day. And then I want to extrapolate from that some claim about human morality. Mm-hmm. That's a mistake. I can't, because the domain of science is limited to description, and it cannot talk about prescription. Mm-hmm. Which is how something should be, mm-hmm. or ought to be. From the other direction, lots of moral philosophers have made the similar point that, you know, looking at nature is not really, even if it's a very careful and rigorous look, it's not really going to tell you anything about morality. It's just not suited for that. Mm-hmm. It's doing a different kind of job. So Gould at one point gives examples of questions, you know, that he thinks these should fall in the domain of religion. Are we worth more than bugs because we've evolved a more complex neurology? Do we ever have a right to drive a species to extinction? Do we violate a moral code when we use genetic technology to splice genes, that sort of thing, which has become even more, much more relevant since he wrote that. He says, such questions simply cannot be answered or even much illuminated by factual data of any kind. And he's right about that. At least I'm going to come down on the side saying he's right about that. Like, you know, Kant, a famous moral philosopher who I'm a big fan of, said, look, the fundamental aspect of morality is obligation. There are obligations that we're all under, and you simply cannot opt out of them. That's what makes them an obligation. And you cannot explain an obligation like that with appeal to anything descriptive. Like, I can't look around in the world and find a thing and say, aha, this is the thing, this, you know, fact about our evolutionary past, or this fact about my psychological development, or whatever it might be, this fact about societies and how they're formed, and use that to explain, justify, or condemn this, you know, moral point. That's just not morality. Morality is about obligation, and obligation is something you can't opt out of. As he said, it's categorical, not hypothetical. That's getting too nerdy.
Mm-hmm.
The point is an order different? And Gould thinks, maybe we could press him on this, but Gould thinks that science is about is and religion is about ought.
Okay.
And so he wants to make religion primarily ethical.
I mean, religion is also about how what is came about, right?
Yeah. So lots of religious people have had a lot to say about that, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So there are claims about the world. And this is what riled up both the apologists and the new atheists about his view, which is that they both see religion as making factual claims about the world that can be disproven, or at least we can give evidence for or against them. The apologists thought we could prove them, and the atheists thought we could disprove them, mm-hmm. right? But I think that's to not quite take his view as fairly as you could, because he's not denying that they pronounce upon the same questions often, and that the conversation between the two sides must be had, and that it will be contentious. He's denying that they're using the same methods.
Yeah.
Again, right? We keep coming back to that. They're simply not. So when religious person makes a factual claim about the world, mm-hmm. what would be a kind of factual claim? I mean, God exists.
Or the creation of the world. How about?
Factual, yeah. God made the world would mm-hmm. be a...
And this is how he did it.
So there we get into dangerous territory.
Yes.
Right? So let's just stick with the God exists and made the world.
Yep.
That's metaphysics.
That's okay.
And that's fine. Because, and you know, the scientists really shouldn't have anything to say about that. It's just not within their domain. It's not within their tool set to make any claims about one way or another. If you think Big Bang cosmology proves that God created the world, you just don't know enough about Big Bang cosmology. Like, it just doesn't. And this comes from somebody who tried real hard to see how it did for several years. It just doesn't. And you could say similar things in the other direction. So that's a fine claim.
Mm-hmm.
God exists. I don't think there's any conflict there at all with science. God did this very specific developmental thing begins to get a little different.
Yes.
Right? Because that does become testable. If you want to say this is something that Gould would have been really annoyed by, one of the things he was famous for was his theory. He tried to figure out why we can tell there have been many like mass extinction events in the just from the fossil record in the history of evolution, and then several like explosive development events where a lot of new forms came into being all at once, like within a few million years, but like super fast on evolutionary timescales. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things he researched and, you know, formulated theories about was what explained that biologically speaking. And, you know, it's so easy as a theist to look at that and say, well, you know, God reached in and created some new mm-hmm. organisms. That's a violation of Noma.
Yep.
Because you're using the kind of methods of theology to make a conclusion about this very specific kind of question for which we already have a method for figuring out that question.
Yeah.
And the same thing could go in the other direction.
I'm smiling because I'll bet when you said we had mass extinction events and then all of a sudden a bunch of life burst into being in really quick, you know, really yeah. quickly. And I'll bet a bunch of people who are maybe still stuck in a little bit of young earth creation were like, yes. And then all of a sudden you said,
there's a window
over the course of a few million years. And like, oh,
you know, a lot of us, maybe this happened to you. We had kind of a slower trajectory out of young earth creationism. Mm-hmm. It wasn't straight into theistic evolution or whatever from that. It was,
I believe in microevolution.
Yes.
Then I believe in macroevolution.
But not macro.
Yeah, yeah.
Or we were old earth creationists for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of us really liked Hugh Ross for a while, who very explicitly makes that kind of claim. Like, you know, we can falsify this kind of scientific creationism. And like one of the things that it states is that those bursts in growth are due to direct creative acts by God. So we were all tempted by that for a little while.
It's a journey.
Yeah. So I think Gould is right, is basically what that comes down to. And
it sounds right to me.
I'm fine to defend his view against it. And he makes the claim, I think he's right about this, that he's defending what was at the time maybe unpopular to the loudest voices, but has been the majority opinion of experts in both domains for like ever, since there's been science, right? I think he's right about that too. If you're interested more on that, read the book. But he makes these two claims that I want to focus on just for a minute here. I think they're extremely fair and reasonable. One is that the magisteria are equal in importance. He's an agnostic, bordering on an atheist, and he is very careful and respectful to distinguish the bad exponents of religion from religion itself and say, this is extraordinarily important to human life, and what my atheistic colleagues are doing in maligning it is despicable.
Like, yeah, that's cool. I mean, I think a lot of religious people would get pissed by saying they're equal, and a lot of scientists would get pissed by saying they're equal.
And our goal should always be to piss off as many people equally as possible.
That sounds like both sidesism right there, buddy.
Yeah, that was a joke. So, yeah, they're both super important and equal, and we're not privileging one over the other and saying this. They each have their own domain, and each domain is essential to human life.
Huh.
Like, you can't be you can't experience everything human life has to offer fully without engaging deeply in the questions that both of them deal with.
Hmm.
Like, if you've ever seen the Big Bang Theory or even just Star Trek, right? There's always these hyper-logical characters who have gone completely in the direction of science at the expense of everything else. And they're farcical. They're comical characters. They're there to teach us that specific lesson that we need the other stuff to. So they're both equally important, but also they are logically distinct styles of inquiry, and blending them is a mistake. And I think we can hold both things equally, and I think that's correct. And here's where it maybe gets uncomfortable for you, I don't know. The tendency to syncretism, to make them, you know, pull them together, it's threatening that logical distinction. So here's an example of syncretism. He actually notes a few in the book. Quantum mechanics reveals something about the nature of Jesus. Like, you know, quantum entanglement shows us something about like the dual nature of Christ or something like that. Real claims that theologians have made or that you see headlines about. Something in the Bible, pick your favorite thing that the Bible says is scientifically accurate or scientifically prescient, or we find out some new thing about the world. It can be in cosmology, but it can also be in like archaeology, right? Mm-hmm. And suddenly we have a greater respect for the Bible, or we say, oh, the Bible's right about that, with the implication that God was like priming us for this discovery or this fact or something like that. That's bordering on violating NOMA. Science shows that if you want to come from a different direction, trying to piss off some liberals here, of which I am one, science shows somehow that all humans are the same and that therefore religion should be primarily like progressive liberal political action. It would also be a violation of NOMA on this view. Some new physical discovery proves God's existence, like Big Bang cosmology, for example, or inflationary theory or whatever. And suddenly the universe has a beginning and therefore God ought to exist because something had to begin it. That violates NOMA too, right? So there's all these things that, you know, reasonable religious people want to do that fall prey to this distinction. So It's not a like a happy-go-lucky, friendly, let's all get along kind of view. Mm-hmm. It's each one has their domain and they should keep their damn mouths shut about the other one kind of view, but they must keep talking.
Sure. Now, I understand, and I think that's mostly true, but I think that stance... Let me just make it personal. I think your skepticism, you know, you've heard me talk about science in sermons, or you've heard me, you gave a few examples. I don't remember exactly what they were. I think if the person, let's just say from my perspective, if the person or pastor or church leader or whatever is trying to seem like an authority or equating scientific fact and discovery to religious like phenomena.
Yeah.
That might be too far, right? Like that's taking one for one is, I think, that seems like syncretism and it's too far. But looking at the origin and nature of the universe and how things work and operate, and if you see or sense that like this seems consistent with what I know from the scriptures about the nature of God and what the life of Christ is like and what we're called to, and that I believe that God is love and that created the world in love and all of it is heading towards somewhere good. If you see something within science that kind of says that hints at that, I think that's fun. And it doesn't have to be syncretism because we don't have to turn it into religious discovery
so
now.
My thought about that is that if you're in a very self-aware way using science to hint at that yourself, I'm okay, I think, with that. I wouldn't do it, but I think I'm okay with it. But if you're saying that science is hinting at it, that's a different thing.
No, I'm saying nature is hinting at it, not science.
Yeah, but you know about nature through science.
Yeah, sure.
Right? So I think that is a violation.
Well, so, for example, when we get all these new Webb telescope pictures out, they're incredible. I think that next Sunday I put them up on the large screen and we like prayed our way through them and kind of worshiped our way through them in many ways, right?
Yeah.
And that's just because the new discoveries, the 7 light years, of all this stuff just is mind-blowing. And we believe, I believe, my God, it like actually had a part of that that process and is holding all that together. I mean, the scriptures say that like Christ holds all things together. The Hebrews, it says, in the power of his word. And Colossians, it says that Christ holds all things together in himself. And that expands so much when all of a sudden we see these new images of what's going on in the universe that happened millions and millions of years ago, right? Yeah. And that, I think, if you can use that for worship rather than fear, why not?
Yeah. I think it's the responsibility of the person using it in that way to make it clear that the tools that they're using to make the point do not themselves make the point. So, you know, nothing about James Webb telescope or the people using it or the people who designed it or the people who are drawing scientific conclusions on the basis of its findings has anything to do with the point that God holds all things together.
Yeah, I mean, I saw people on Twitter saying things like the Webb telescope is an instrument of worship.
You know, in the right sense and context, I'm fine with it. If all they mean is I'm using it as an instrument of worship, great.
Yep.
It itself isn't. That's,
yeah, of course.
That's
a guitar isn't itself either. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But yes, my axe is only an instrument of worship insofar as I shred it on stage in a church. Yeah. So, where my hackles go up is when we fail to make the distinction between the thing itself and the use of the thing to make a thoroughly religious point. Mm-hmm. There isn't anything scientific about that point. If you want to say... And another worry about this, which is consonant with NOMA, but honestly, it's consonant with a certain kind of more reticent religiosity. Like I've heard Reformed theologians make this kind of point. Like they tend to be a little Reformed theology in general tends to be a little suspicious of new arguments for God's existence, especially ones that are related to science, because they think it's too shaky of a foundation to like base your belief in God, because science changes, right? And so they're not happy with that. So what happens if I've come out and said, you know, this new scientific discovery or this new scientific tool has supported this religious doctrine, and then 10 or 50 or 100 years later, that scientific discovery is overturned and its opposite is now in vogue. Does that like undermine my theological view? If so, that's a concern. So like, you don't even have to be a proponent of Noma to be a little suspicious of uses of science in that way.
Yeah, no, I completely say basing your religious understandings off of scientific understanding is a bad practice. Like, that's going way too far.
The nerdy part of me is also just, it annoys me because the science is almost never accurate, right? Now, when it's James Webb, that's fine because we can all look at the pictures. It's just a tool that helps us to see what we can't see with our naked eye. And what we can see with our naked eye is already extraordinary, right? So I'm fine with that. But like, almost every use of science, especially like recent scientific discoveries that only a handful of people in the world actually understand, that are used for religious purposes, even if they're making a kind of vague or relatively innocuous religious point, the person speaking just doesn't know what they're talking about.
No, yeah.
And if you ask the scientists, do you agree with this use of your view? They're going to be like, what? That should give us pause, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, and again, there's a difference between just reading the data that the scientists discovered and saying, oh my goodness, that's incredible. What does it say about our God? That's one thing. And then trying to interpret that data in some way, shape, or form, or trying to pretend that I understand it and how it came about. Right. Those are two different things.
Good. Okay. Well, maybe we didn't disagree as much as I'd hoped we would.
Yeah. Sorry.
Damn it. Always happens.
I just know in my spiritual journey that recently, especially in the last 5 or so years, the more I hear about particularly astronomy and cosmology, the more I hear about discoveries in the universe, the more I'm filled with wonder, the more I'm filled with mystery, the more I'm filled with awe, and the more I'm filled with worship. And that has made me, I think, a better follower of Jesus. It's made me a better Christian, and it's made me a better human being, because I get a real dose of humility.
Yeah.
I get a real dose of my place in the world, in the universe, in history. And I get a real dose of also wonder at, like, if there really is a God, like I really think there is, and I've been, you know, spending my whole adult life talking about, that being, that, you know, ground of all being is just so beyond my understanding that it actually makes me want to fall down and worship even more. And and also hold this, like the apophatic stuff that we talk about in the tradition, to say, how could I ever hope to know you? You know, I mean, there's, and that actually produces more affection and devotion in me to say, like, I've been so wrong for so long because I thought I had a handle on God. I've been so wrong for so long because I thought I had a handle on reality and the universe, which is such a ridiculous thing to say. But many of us religious people do that. But the more scientific discovery comes about, the more I realize how little I know and how little I am. But I still believe that there's a God who holds it all, who originated it all, and who will redeem it all. And I don't think those things are intention. I think that is, we can say yes and amen to both if we're very careful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. Yeah, I'm fully on board with that. I totally fine saying, and I wholeheartedly believe that God uses nature in various ways and uses, you know, the investigations of careful people who disagree with you in various ways to humble you and to highlight how much you're not God. And I think that serves a very useful religious function. And I don't see any conflict there either. And Gould would agree. You're living an impoverished human life if you're not experiencing that kind of thing, whether you're a theist or not. There's totally secular versions of that too, right? Where people have their own kind of existential experience, partially based on scientific discovery. And it doesn't lead them anywhere towards theism or religion. But nonetheless, there's something deeply human about recognizing just how small you are in this whole thing, but how meaningful your life is in spite of or because of that.
And I think going back to the beginning of our conversation, the bad arguments against, you know, other science or religion, and then coming back to this point where, like, how about we just agree to, whether it's in our spiritual journey or in a yearning for scientific understanding, we just hold both things with humility.
Yeah.
And know how much we know and know how much we don't know. And try not to cross-pollinate too much and try to let one and let those two things live separately. And also when they intermingle, praise the Lord. Great. But let's hold humility like we've talked about recently in, on this podcast as well, and not pretend we know what we don't know.
Amen. Well, that's it for this episode of A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We hope you're enjoying the show as much as we are. Help us continue to create compelling content and reach a wider audience by supporting us at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher, where you can get bonus content, extra perks, and a general feeling of being a good person.
Also, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and Spotify. These help new people discover the show, and we may even read your review in a future episode, if it's good enough.
If anything we said really pissed you off, or if you just have a question you'd like us to answer, or if you'd just like to send us booze, send us an email at pastorandphilosopher@gmail.com.
Catch all of our hot takes on Twitter at @PPWBpodcast, @RandyNye, and @RobertKWhitaker, and find transcripts and links to all of our episodes at pastorandphilosopher.buzzsprout.com. See you next time.
Cheers.